Hello, iGaming Intelligentsia. Before we start today's podcast, here is a message from our sponsors. The iGaming Next podcast is made possible with the support from our sponsors at Pragmatic Solutions, leaders in intelligent platform technology. I've been working with Ashley, Lewis, and the guys over at Pragmatic Solutions over the last year. And as the early supporter of this podcast, I cannot recommend them enough. The Pragmatic Solutions Player Account Management Platform is an incredibly powerful technology stack for today's gaming business. Their modern modular platform provides all the core services to power your business, and their SaaS licensing model allows you to reduce cost and accelerate your strategic goals. Enterprise technology with decades of operational know-how at scale built in. Upgrade your business to the Pragmatic Solutions PAM platform. Visit www.pragmatic.solutions to arrange a platform demo.
Future trends, deep insights, industry leaders. This is the iGaming Next podcast with your host, Pierre Lindt.
Lina, Falk, how is it feeling to be on the other side of the microphone today?
It's lovely. Thank you for having me. I think we were long overdue this chat, so I'm really excited to be your guest.
Yeah, likewise, Karina. We've been speaking about doing this podcast for quite a long time, of course, even before you started to host your own podcast here together at iGaming Next. So fantastic to have you here, Karina. And we were talking just before here about all the bugs and stuff like that we've been dealing with kind of recording this podcast from time to time. There's like so many things behind the recordings that goes on that like just raises your blood sugar and all of that. But hopefully today we should be okay. Yeah, exactly. But today we have the comfortability of we both know each other and we can do this recording. Whatever goes wrong is completely fine because we are here together and we'll just have fun.
I love that word, comfortability. I'm not sure there is one like that in the dictionary, is there?
I don't know. Now there is, I guess.
There is.
We just invented it. So Karolina, the topic of today is the ups and downs of a high achiever. And the reason why I chose this topic is, again, what we talked about here before the podcast is, one of the silver linings of the pandemic has been that we have got to know each other. And throughout this year and a half that we've been kind of working together and, we've been starting to talk on a daily basis and things like that. I've always seen you as a high achiever. That's always been the impression that I've gotten from, seeing your appearances and kind of following you throughout the years and so on and so forth. And getting to know you throughout this year and a half, I have also highlighted, that as a high achiever, things are not always roses and sunshines. And I know that you have been wanting to talk about that for a long time, and so have I as well. So that's kind of why I wanted to kind of put that topic of this podcast today. So I'm very excited for the discussion. And I want to open up with a question to get the discussion going here, which is, looking back at your career, Karolina, you come from, you had a stint at LeoVegas, and before that, I remember you told me the story, you were working on a cruise ship, and you had a very exciting kind of journey how you got to the point today now as the CEO and founder of SharedPlay. But can you talk about, have you always been a high achiever? And how did you get to where you are today?
I should probably start with, stop it, Pierre. I'm not a high achiever. Yeah. But, I've matured enough in my life to understand I am a high achiever. And there is nothing to be humble about. So, I guess I have always been. I come from a family of professional sportsmen. My mom was a professional sports woman. My father was a professional sportsman. So there has always been sort of this focus on achievements in my family, not to any sort of extreme levels, but it's been valued. And I've been brought up in a house where you know, I was taught to fight for what you want to have. So I was very good at school, and I was very self-driven. I mean, I was one of those kids that, you know, write math Olympiads and Polish Olympiads and write poems and essays and so on. I was always the first ones to raise my hand where my homework was ready and so on. So I always liked working for it. It didn't come very hard to me either, so it wasn't like I had to study day and night, but I also always liked recognition and sharing sort of my expertise, so at school. But then, you know, I had this slight turn when I became a teenager, where things totally turned around for me, and I wanted to be a social high achiever instead of an academic high achiever. So that was a shock to my parents, because I literally started skipping school and, you know, just decided I'm not interested at all. And my parents have gone through a rough patch of 4 years that completely changed their experience with me. But I, you know, and that also influenced my choices of university and quitting university early on. So I guess ever since I became a little bit more aware of what I want and what I'm interested in, they realized that they have no control over me anymore. And they just let me sort of go the direction I wanted to go. And I, you know, I quit university after 1 year. I went to study journalism, interestingly enough. So being host of a podcast and publishing articles is very much giving me fulfillment in the area, because I always like writing. But I don't feel I needed to finish that course. I was bored. I didn't think it was taking me anywhere. And I was much more interested in making money and working and being independent. So I guess for me, the sort of strive for something different started early on. I was 20 when I started working for the first time, and I come from a humble background. My very first job was actually as a dealer, as a croupier in a casino in Poland. And you know, many people that I started with, they still work there many years later. I did 1 year and I wanted more. So I went to UK. This was the time where Poland joined the European Union. And I was given an opportunity to work in a London-based casino. I worked in 50 St. James, which was one of the most prestigious VIP clubs in the world back then. And again, I did 1 year of that, and it was exciting. I learned a lot of characteristics of high roller players, and you know, was taught how to deal to the Sultan of Brunei and then, you know, Philip Green and so on. But after 1 year, it wasn't enough either. So I decided to go on a cruise ships, and cruise ships was very much fulfilling my dream of traveling and getting to know the world. And I spent 3 years working as a dealer, and then sort of progressing through the ranks, working on VIP cruises and as a host. And again, this wasn't something I was going to settle at. So that was the time where I decided, okay, enough is enough. I've done a bit of traveling. This job that was supposed to be a temporary job for a little bit is running its course. I need to go back to university. So I applied for university in London. I got two offers, and I decided to go back. But before I managed to start the university course, I got offered a job in a conference production company. Again, very relevant to what I'm helping you with these days. Yeah. But I met someone on a cruise ship that was the owner of a really big conference company called IQPC. And he knew that I wasn't fulfilled anymore in the dealer's role, and I wanted to do something different with my life, but it was quite difficult for me to get any kind of job back then, because, you know, 5 years in casinos and where do you go from there? So he helped me out, and he offered me a conference producer role in the oil and gas industry in Eastern Europe. So I was doing conferences around oil and gas supply chain. I was doing conferences around the Chernobyl protection shelter, including a field trip to Chernobyl, and about sort of natural gas sources. So, I mean, complete step back from gaming and something completely different, unknown. It wasn't my passion, and it wasn't something I was going to stay in, but it gave me, you know, 6 to 9 months of events organizing experience, marketing experience. I learned how to copyright. I learned how to do field research, and sort of the office manners that I was lacking. I didn't know how to use Outlook or anything before. So that was when I realized I can put those skills to use and go back to my origin, which is gaming, and start to apply for the online gaming roles. So that was the beginning of how I got into the industry. And right. You know, from something that was supposed to be a summer job, to an industry that I started to consider something I can potentially, you know, consider as a career.
Yeah, very, very interesting. How was the oil and gas company industry from the inside?
Well, it was hard, especially, you know, I had to do research about supply chains where I didn't actually know what a supply chain meant in English when I first started, with folks based out of Aberdeen and Texas, where I couldn't understand their accents at all. Yeah. So it was a difficult experience. And then I had to do research with Russians and sort of Eastern European representatives from natural gas sources and Chernobyl. But interestingly, on one of my events, because I was organizing conferences for senior executives, and one of those conferences was in Poland, in Marriott Hotel. And as a entertainment in the evening, I organized a casino evening for them in the casino I used to work in. So there was always some kind of pull back to the industry, even during my little detour.
Interesting. And I mean, then you so somehow you then ended up in Malta at some stint, right? And you had a period in Las Vegas.
That came after. So I started in London. I worked for Inter Casino and Inter Poker. I was a poker VIP manager back then. I worked with poker players.
Same here. I come from that background too. 2 years Betsson to poker VIP, yes.
So that was that job. I interviewed with Jesper Svensson, who is now the CEO of Betsson Group. And he was the one that decided to give me a chance because I didn't have the right skill set. I had some understanding of players from land base, but I didn't know how to do a marketing executive job.
What year was that? Sorry to interrupt, Karolina.
2009, I think.
Right. Well, I was 2011 to 2013. I was the VIP of BetSafe. Okay, continue.
Sorry. Yeah. So it was right before a year before Black Friday. So interesting time to start in the industry, especially in the poker industry.
That's for sure.
So yeah, I stayed in London for around 5 years, and I worked first there. Then the company moved to Malta, and I was like, I'm not moving to Malta. I love London. I want to stay, which, you know, didn't save me from ending up in Malta anyway at some point.
Yeah.
But I moved to Bodog UK back then, and I worked as a marketing manager for their brands. I did a short stint at Paddy Power as well in between, traveling to Dublin twice a week sometimes. And I was organizing the Irish Poker Festival for Paddy Power. So that was the poker. And only then I went to Manila. I worked for the Bodog brand in Manila, helping to set up the office and bringing some expertise from Europe.
Calvin Aaron, the guy, son?
Calvin wasn't involved back then because we worked on the regulated side of the thing. So we worked for Bodog UK, which was the first licensed online casino in UK, funny enough. And then in Manila, we worked mostly on the organizational and sort of knowledge transfer side of things. So I spent 2 years in Manila, and only from there, I went to Malta and followed Jasper again, because Jasper became a managing director of Betsson, and he reached out to me. He left Manila a couple of years before me, and he was like, listen, it's a great company. I think you should explore opportunities and come to Malta. You love it here. So I followed him, ended up in Betsson, did a couple of years in Betsson, and then moved on, was going to move to Spain for another job. But there was this one company that I was always looking at and thinking, this is a really interesting company. I mean, back then, everyone was talking about LeoVegas. They were the first mobile casino. They were in all the papers. They were getting all the awards. And I remember there was a head of HR leaving from Betsson, Frida, and she was going to work for Leo. And I said to her, listen, if there's any opportunity to work on the casino side of things at Leo, please let me know, because I'd be super interested. They called me 2 weeks later. They didn't have an opportunity, but they created an opportunity. And I guess the rest of my time at Leo is sort of history.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's an amazing kind of career. And it really shines through this kind of high achiever mindset, so to say, that you see the opportunity and you go for it. You know, I think a lot of people, they kind of get stuck in their in their position, so to say, not knowing to some extent how to move on from there, and you know, I think that's also totally okay as well. Many people don't want to be high achievers, and I think that's important to highlight as well, that again, going, like pursuing this kind of high growth, all-in type mindset, it's not always the easiest path either. You know, so on that note, you know, I know that you've talked about kind of imposter syndrome, then, which is something, you know, that I've thought a lot about as well myself. And you know, for those who don't know, imposter syndrome is kind of it's kind of when you question yourself in your position, not feeling that you deserve it. Let's say, is that a fair description? Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what's interesting is that a lot of people that we look up to as professionals, they walk around feeling like they don't deserve their title, which doesn't make sense when you see the people from the outside. But to them, they are wondering how they got so lucky to get in these shoes, and they are just waiting for someone to like stand up and call them out, essentially. And it's very, very common that high achievers, people of high positions, have this syndrome. Joe Rogan of the podcast, he talks a lot about imposter syndrome, that he doesn't feel like he deserves the attention that he has, for example. But can you talk a little bit about kind of your experience with imposter syndrome and how you have dealt with that in your career?
I don't think I've dealt with that because I'm not entirely sure you can do this easily. I think it's years of sort of therapy and, you know, getting external help to deal with this. I've definitely experienced imposter syndrome multiple times in my career, and I've only came to a realization that I'm experiencing it not so long ago. But it has always been this kind of, rather than recognizing the drive that I had to change jobs and keep climbing, in the jobs that I had, and you know, I studied full time while working full time when I was in London. I also requalified from marketing into product, so I did sort of two roles at the same time, so I could shadow product and I could turn into product manager. So I used to look at all these things as something that was given to me and that I was lucky to get, rather than something that I fought for and made. myself happen for me, right? So and I didn't realize it, and every time I got a new job, I was pushing myself extremely hard to prove myself and almost like to justify that I was worth the risk to give me that job, to create the role for me, and so on. And was told by people quite often that, you know, you're a head of casino at Betsson, for example. I had people telling me, you act as if you were the owner of the business, because not in a arrogant way, just in the commitment that you give to it. You work so many hours and evenings, and you stress so much as if your life depended on it. And that's probably was driven by the fact that I wanted to justify that I was worthy of the position. And it carried through when I was consulting. You know, I consulted at executive level for some of the biggest companies on the market, and the trust has been given to me by really experienced leaders who worked with me in the past. And yet every time at the beginning of the consulting engagement, I was feeling that I don't deserve it. And maybe they'll see through that I don't have all that expertise that they're counting on. And only a few months in, when I was delivering sort of reports and seeing the impact I'm making on the business and on other people, it was settling, saying, actually, you know, I didn't believe in myself, but I've got all that. And I am making a change to them with my expertise. So. Yeah, it's been present throughout my career, and it is present now. You know, there's this documentary on Netflix about Elizabeth Holmes, who was responsible for the sort of the biggest scam in Silicon Valley, where she convinced loads of investors about her idea for blood testing. I think the company was called Kronos. I highly recommend this documentary because it's good. And I watched it, you know, and I've seen how it all unfolded and how the company called a unicorn then became valued at zero, all of because of the perception she created and then the lies she told and certain failings that she did. And a couple of weeks later, I was dreaming about this, that I am Elizabeth Holmes. I was, you know, subconsciously comparing myself to her, saying, what if I fooled everyone? What if, you know, this is not going to work and this concept is not going to catch on and I'm going to burn through all the money and I don't know how to manage a startup. So all these thoughts were coming through, and even more so because I decided to be public with the journey and announced the company early, pre-product, pre-POC, really. So it could have been that 3 months down the line, we would realize, you know, some of the elements are not possible to execute. Luckily, we didn't. But I had all these thoughts. And rather than focus on the fact that, you know, the trend that I've spotted has been highlighted in many other products, it's not something completely out of the blue. There are other companies going that direction, which is sort of validation of the idea, that I have great team. You know, we had great early stages of the product when we got investment, and the investors also, rather than see it as they invested in me because they knew me. So if I was weak or not good enough, they would have known because they've worked me with before. I was looking at it thinking people would see this as me being lucky because they invested in me just because they knew me. And, you know, quite a few times someone highlighted saying, you know, no one invests 1.7 million in someone else because they like them or because they want to be nice to them. So, yeah, this has to be highlighted to me a couple of times. So I shake off this doubts and, you know, imposter feeling.
There is this funny quote when you... people who are expecting their first child, you know, some parents, they get very nervous before they have the first child. Like, can we handle this? You know, oh my God, this completely new experience. Like, yeah, we're not ready for this. You know, a lot of people feel. And the answer to that, I think, is if you are really nervous, you are already doing better than most parents. So I think that the purpose of the quote is basically saying, if you're not nervous, you're just not making enough effort. So do you think that can be, can imposter syndrome in that regard be something positive? Because what you are saying is almost like, you know, because you have this imposter syndrome, it's almost like forces you to do this extra effort in order to deliver even better results than what you're expected to do.
Yeah, of course. And this is related exactly to the subject of your podcast, the ups and downs of being a high achiever, because imposter syndrome is a trait that is characteristic for the people who come from houses with where achievements are valued, which is what we talked about in relation to my background, and also for people who are absolute perfectionists. I am a perfectionist, and I experience this imposter syndrome. So whereas it has some downsides potentially to my mental health, that sometimes is a bit too much pressure and, you know, could cause anxiety, it definitely has benefits to the drive and to how thoroughly I consider things and how much I want to prove people that I'm going to make this happen, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It makes total sense, you know? You know, I can say from my own perspective, you know, for me, the imposter syndrome manifests in periods, I would say, because I would have periods where I feel very confident in the company that I'm building. But then there would be other periods where I just feel like, oh my God, like I really don't know what I'm doing kind of thing. I don't know if you go through these periods as well, or is it like more consistent for you?
Of course, there are days when I don't know what I'm doing. I mean, it's a completely new adventure for me, right? Yeah. But I have this... I guess it's a skill or a talent that I don't get scared when I don't know what I'm doing. I reach out for help. I just go out and ask people for advice. I'm, you know, a master networker. I talk to people multiple times a day on various channels, and I give my advice. And thanks to that, I can always ask for an advice. So when I have those days that I really don't know what I'm doing, I go for reassurance. I ask people, I talk to them openly about it, and quite often they point me towards the right direction. I guess for me, the imposter syndrome comes through sometimes. For example, when I'm hiring people, you know, I'm trying to be very authentic when I talk to them about the vision and what I want to achieve and what kind of company this is going to be. And I get very excited and passionate. It comes through because they say, and most of them were interested in joining because of the authenticity. And they said it was one of the first times where someone has been this transparent and open with them about what this company is supposed to be. And then, you know, I get them on board, they accept, and then I get these doubts of what if I promise them things that are not going to materialize? What if, you know, this is not going to be the company that I've envisioned? What if the culture isn't what I'm dreaming for it to be, but I won't be able to make it happen. And that these are the hard ones, because that's when, you know, this is your team and these are the people that trusted you. And when you have doubts about what you've promised them, wasn't it too much passion driven? Is it possible to make this happen? That's where it really hits you hard. But then I revisit all those things, and not once I had to go back on my word and say, it's not going to be like that. I was over promising a little bit, because I truly believe that when I speak with people authentically, I speak from the heart and of what I really think that can happen, rather than giving them a sales pitch or, you know, a thoroughly crafted recruitment pitch.
I have a theory, Carolina, that I want to share with you. And we say all the time in our company, as one of our ethos, that authenticity beats perfection. And that shows kind of in the content that we do in the podcast. You know, we don't really edit the podcast, right? It's like from start to finish, and it is what it is. If we misspeak, that's still in there. And you know, we do that for the reason that we think that if we can shine through with our personalities, you know, doing this for 100 episodes, 200 episodes, you really get to know the people. Being authentic, it instills trust at the end of the day. And I think that people want authenticity. People don't want perfection. People want to see how you think, like, where are your mistakes, where are your flaws? And they want to kind of understand how your mind works in order to kind of connect with the discussions and stuff like that. But I have a theory that I have never formulated in words, but I've been thinking about this. I'll see if I can pull it off. But, you know, the crypto space and the blockchain space is becoming very, you know, all over the place. And the basic premise of the crypto purists, the Bitcoin evangelists, is essentially that decentralization is the future. You know, the decentralization beats centralization. We don't need the middleman and so on and so forth. And I think that the rise and rise of the crypto and blockchain space is a manifestation of people's craving for honesty and transparency and authenticity, because there is nothing more transparent than the blockchain. And so when Bitcoin is the ultimate trustable medium. You know, you can do trustless transaction. You can put all your wealth you ever accumulated ever into this blockchain, and you can feel safe. And I think that is what ticks the box for the Bitcoin and blockchain purists in that regard. It's just this craving for authenticity, and I think this can translate into organizations. So I think, if there's anything that this movement has proved, is that people want the transparency, they want authenticity. So if organizations can be more and more authentic and transparent, they will perhaps gain the same trust or similar trust as the Bitcoin evangelists and the supporters are giving to the crypto and blockchain space. And I do think that it's a trend that is clear, that we are moving towards this transparency, authenticity, and decentralization, clearly. I don't know if that is making sense.
No, totally, and I agree. And I think it's just seen on many other levels as well, even on social media, there's this big drive to sort of remove the filters and all this sort of, tools that help you make the world prettier and better and so on. So people do want authentic things. For me, just going back to the perfectionist versus transparency and authenticity, I have always been authentic in communication. So when it comes to perfectionist, it's more about the execution, the planning, time management, in those aspects. But when it comes to communicating, whether that's with teams or new hires or even podcasts or media appearances, I never prepare or rehearse, because I don't enjoy doing the presentation for the second time. So I find it difficult to prepare to the point that I'll rehearse what I'm going to say, because I lose the passion on the second time round. So I make some notes, of course, but I would never be able to stand in a mirror and follow the techniques of speech coaches and so on, how to hold my hands. And it's just not for me and never has been. So, you know, that's one interesting thing. And it probably will backfire one day when I'll completely lose my track and forget what I was going to say. But this was pointed out to me once when we were doing the road show before Leo Vegas went public. You know, I was asked to do product presentations for the investors and the representatives. And one of them did come over to me and said after, listen, this was one of the most authentic product presentations I've seen in a while. And it was one of the most believable ones because I knew that you didn't prepare, you know, an investor pitch there to highlight just the strengths. You just gave it as it is. And that made me really believe it and really get on board with it.
I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. I think, you know, it's the same. We tell our sales guys all the time as well that, you know, it's not about this old school sales technique where you like perfect the pitch and it's like you say the right words in the right moment, in the right tone of voice, and you convince the person who is on the other side to like fall for your product. You know, it's like if you're a good person, if you have a good product, be yourself, because in the end of the day, if you ask yourself like how do you sell to Carolina Pelk, and it would be for you, I'm guessing now, right, it would be if you feel trust to the person, if you feel that you can see that the person had good intentions, not that they are saying the right words, then you'll be comfortable to purchase from them, right?
No, totally. I've got a bullshit radar and filter, so I cut through it really fast. So when people are selling to me, it needs to be passion, it needs to be true, and I need to believe it, because otherwise I'm just not interested.
Yeah, we always say like always be yourself. Mm. Except if you're a serial killer, then don't be yourself.
Okay.
Yeah. Then it's okay. Then it's okay to not be yourself. But if you're a good person, then I think the best salespeople are the ones who genuinely are authentic and friendly and who more than anything care to make the world a little bit better. Genuinely. And those I think are the ones that you actually want to talk to rather than just hearing this like perfected pitch. And I think it's the same with, you know, the speaking coaches as well that we see sometimes. For me, it's like they are putting a filter in front. Like I don't see who they are, like, and it makes you question. You know, for me, I see like a lot of motivational speakers who are really good at building this energy to people and whatnot. But sometimes I feel a bit mistrust to some of them because I just don't know what is behind that. And for me, it's much more important for me to give my trust to someone or to like trust their words. I really want to see who the person is. I wanted them to talk about their flaws, you know?
Yeah.
Not what their flaws used to be. It's like, I used to be, you know, have all these problems, but now I'm perfect and you should listen to me. It's like, well, hold on a minute. No one is perfect, first of all. And if you want to tell others how they should improve, then I think you should admit your own mistakes, like what you did wrong today or yesterday or whatever. Then I will listen a lot more. I think that's much more authentic. But I think that's missing sometimes from like these professional speakers and professional motivators and stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And that's why I think the podcast medium as well is really powerful, because you know, when you do, I think, a certain amount of hours of this podcast, it's impossible to keep a face for hundreds of hours and still enjoy it. You know, at the end of the day, both you and me, we do this podcast because we love it. You know, we learn from the people that we are with, and we have super interesting conversations. And I think this podcast medium has really kind of give birth to the authenticity that we can bring to people, and hopefully you know, that can inspire people to be better, even though you don't really give any, you know, world-class advice or whatever, you know.
Yeah, I agree.
Absolutely. So you know, back to kind of the high achiever discussion here, Kalina. I'm really curious to know, like, for me, in my general daily work life, I sometimes wake up and I'm just, this is not my day, you know? And I'll admit, today was one of those days, actually. I woke up, I had a flat tire on the car. I lost my wallet today, and I was just not in a good mood, you know? And I just haven't been productive today in general. I sent the outline to you late as well. And I mean, it just didn't feel good today. And do you have these days sometimes too, when you just, it just doesn't click? And how do you handle those days?
I do have those days, but it depends sort of what do I consider being off from. So there are days where I have sort of a lot of small tasks to get through, admin, accounting, payments, and so on. And I just don't feel like doing this. And I feel like this is not progress. This is not taking me anywhere. And I finish the day with feeling of I haven't actually done anything of substance today. It was just so executional. But I still get through those days, and I try to plan those days in specific days of the week so that they become a routine, so that I know that this day is coming and it's not a surprise of having to get through the chores. So that makes it easier. On the other hand, sometimes I have days where I've planned sort of creative workshops with team, and I have to review UX research prepared or have a meeting about sort of designs, and I totally don't feel like it because I just don't have the energy, and I don't feel like I'm gonna give it my full attention. Then I reschedule because product meetings are my creative meetings for which I really need 100% of my focus, my attention span. So I reschedule. I'd rather reschedule them at short notice to another day when I'm feeling better, obviously within reason, because we have timelines and dependencies to consider. But I do reschedule, and then I use this time for stuff that doesn't require for me to feel the passion. So again, I will move some chores from Friday to Tuesday and get through some little things that I can tick off on my to-do list.
Yeah, right. So you generally you like to plan your week in a way where you have your schedule for when you do things. Like it's in your calendar, kind of like today we're gonna focus on product, or like these hours focus on product.
Yeah.
Next hour is management, and you schedule this from day to day. In a sense, yeah. That's how you put.
I'm without being offensive to the obsessive compulsive disorders, because I realize that I say OCD a lot, and sometimes it could be hurtful for people who actually struggle with those orders. But I am maniacal about my planning. It is again a up and down because it lets me be very productive, very organized. I never forget. I'm one of those people that if I sent you an email and you forgot to respond to it, you will get 3 follow-ups in scheduled intervals until you get back to me, or I will put it in the bin and then the conversation is closed. So I use Todoist obsessively. In Todoist, I've got both my private chores and my work chores, work tasks, and I use a Kanban board. I use all kind of prioritization, and I put them in different projects, and I do schedule my week according to the highlights. So I set a big highlight for each day so that I can complete each day with a sense of achievement. And then I give themes to the day. So I have admin days, I have accounting and legal days, I have pure product days, I have team days for where I deal with sort of job descriptions and reviewing applications, getting back to people and so on. The only thing I don't plan for, and that usually is disruptive to my schedule, is networking, because you cannot plan networking. And that comes sort of out of nowhere when someone pings you on Skype and that spirals into half an hour conversation, and someone wants to have a 3-minute call, and then an hour later you're still on that call. So that I've accepted as a disruption because I've learned how much value comes with it. So I don't schedule networking to a certain extent. But apart from that, I'm super organized. I used monday.com for sort of bigger projects where I have people involved and I have to delegate to them, I have to share files with them and so on. My monday.com is automated with Plexi into my Todoist, because Todoist is my preferred tool of choice, because I've been using
it called?
For Plexi? 7 years. Plexi, yeah. It's similar to Zapier, and it fills the need for when you don't have an existing connection and automation within the tool, you can come up with your own. So I feed projects from monday.com, the most urgent one. So basically monday.com I use for longer term planning, and you can find everywhere for the next 3 months in there. Todoist is my next 2 weeks type of thing. So only projects from Radar and this week are fed to my Todoist. And then I put them in a Kanban board, and that feeds my calendar and my Calendly. So my Calendly is also sort of set up to cater to the themes of the day. So when someone wants a call with me, let's say someone wants to sell me accounting services, they'll get a Calendly link with time slots only for the legal and accounting day, so that they can't get the meeting with me on Thursday when I'm supposed to be brainstorming product. And it's really helpful because I know that I'll wake up on a Tuesday and I know that there's not going to be any disruption in terms of paying invoices or getting back to a sales pitch or doing a sales pitch or so on, that this is my product day and I'm going to be looking at research, experimenting, working with my team, you know, seeing demos and providing feedback. Whereas on some other days, I'm prepared for, okay, today I have to pay the invoices, I have to follow up on people who didn't send invoices, I have to compare the exchange rate between different banks or whatever. These are the type of organization that I do. And it is quite effective, but it's also very complex. It would probably take me 2 hours just to explain my inbox management system, where I use the special stars and, you know, and that's also automated with Todoist. It's crazy, but it works for me. So.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you found your system. Like you said, it's something that you have made complex over the years, I would imagine, right? Like you have a set of tools, and then once in a while you change something or you build on it. And for you, it's natural, right? Your brain is wired in a way where this comes natural. But if someone would see it, it would probably look like you're looking at, you know, the Matrix code falling down in the Matrix.
Absolutely. Like, what the hell? For some people, this is overwhelming. And I talked about it in the presentation that I did for you guys some years ago. There are people that are order Muppets, and I'm one of them. And there are people who are chaos Muppets. So there are people who don't need to, you know, flag their emails with different icons and have inbox zero before they leave for the day. They are able to somehow live in a complete harmony with their 1 million unread emails and their crazy desktops with icons and so on. They just use search icons and they find whatever they need, and they have better short-term memory. I rely on my Todoist totally. I don't use short-term memory for anything. So I put all the private things and personal things on there, also family tasks as well. So it has the downside of that if I have an off day and I don't manage to complete all these tasks until I reschedule and rearrange the plan, I feel anxious. So I can't just let go and you know, go and take a nap or feel better or just go and play with my child. And there has been many Saturdays where, you know, I haven't managed to complete my workload on Friday. And even though it was weekend and I'm a big sort of guardian of the family time, I try not to work weekends unless it's sort of in the evening when my child is asleep. I wasn't able to focus. I wasn't able to be present until I sat and reorganized my sort of overdue items for next week. And only then I get peace of mind to relax and think. So that's obviously not a great feeling, but I've learned to accept that there are so many positives on my system for my type of personality, that if they come with some downsides, you know, there is no perfect things. There's always going to be an exchange of good and bad things. So I just accept that. And it's still better for me than to be in this chaos of tasks. And I probably have a million more tasks on my to-dos than an average person, because I'm always thinking of something, of doing something new. So,
yeah, always new ideas. So I talked to this with my friend Lassen Mersog a lot, actually. The fact that we have through our journey as professionals wired our brain in a way where being productive give endorphin kicks. And we say, like, we don't know if that's a good or bad thing at the end of the day. Like, you know, if you look at the grander kind of scheme of life in general, is that what should be our priority for the rest of our lives? You know, we talk about that. Like, is it something we should be aware of? You know, because going into the weekend and like you mentioned, if the inbox is not clear, there's this feeling in the back of your mind that it's like not letting you relax until that is done. And I think that begs a little bit the question here, Carolina. What's your what's the end goal here in general? Like, what are you working so hard towards? What is there an end goal or?
There isn't an end goal. There is an overarching goal of fulfillment. I don't do this. I've never worked to get somewhere. I never started working at a casino thinking I'm going to one day found a gaming business. That was something that was sort of helping me with the current circumstances. I wanted to travel, you know, I was able to travel. And whenever I worked in every company, I didn't strive for a specific position. I didn't want to be a marketing director, or a product director, or a CPO. So I didn't have a predefined journey how to get there. It was just happening naturally. And whenever I saw opportunity for progression and being able to do something different and learn something new, I was going after this. So there isn't an end goal. And with a startup as well, I think it isn't, you know, I didn't do this because I want to exit in 5 years and have a lot of money. That's not the goal. The goal is to be fulfilled now in what I'm doing, to be able to channel my passion and my beliefs into a product where I'm in full control and I can make things happen that I might not have been able to do previously because I wasn't, you know, influential enough or whatever. And it goes all the way to building the company of my dream, of my dreams, not just the product, but also the organization of the ways of working and culture that sits somewhere within me that has those values of transparency, authenticity and passion at the forefront. And I'm now at the driving seat of it, and I'm able to execute on that and hopefully see the fruit one day of people loving to work in it.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you have found yourself in a position now where you have the opportunity to really change an industry. You have an opportunity to really show a lot of inspiring people that perhaps has inspired you, that you can also do something that is of value to the industry. Let's say, is that the angle? Like, is this I mean, you've been in the industry for your whole career more or less, and is it a lot about the passion of the industry as well here that we're talking about?
It is for sure. And it is about the passion for innovation, because I was really fortunate to work for companies that were always experimenting with new things. I mean, when I was at Bodog UK, we were one of the very first brands back then that, you know, had NetEnt games was building sort of the non-downloadable casino right after Mr. Green. At Leo Vegas, we were doing so many cool things that people didn't try before us, and it was fun to see what value this can bring to the company, what value this can bring to the players. So I think working in this project that is all about innovation and all about challenging the status quo and redefining the way that people do certain things is super exciting. And I do realize at some point there will come a time where obviously we're going to face the whole challenges, because I don't have misconception about the startup phase being honeymoon forever. You know, there will be time where we have to deal with regulation. There will be time where our roadmaps are full and we don't have enough resources to pursue the cool ideas, but we have to do the maintenance. I'm aware that's going to come, but I guess I'm really excited about what's now. And I know that for people that come to work for us, this will also be fun for a decent amount of time, even before we get to this higher maturity stage where more challenges will come for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like we can't have the ups without the downs. And I think perhaps to connect this, you know, why be a high achiever? I think when you have to go through all these like big highs and big lows at the same time. And I think what defines a high achiever to some extent is the fact that the lowest lows are still worth to go through, because the highest feels even better.
At the end totally. Of the day.
And so you're completely prepared and completely okay to risk everything in order to potentially reach those high highs. Whereas perhaps people who are more risk averse don't have the same appetite for the swings, let's say. And perhaps that is a little bit what differentiates, you know, the classic entrepreneur, then, who struggles before eventually they succeed, or they fail at the end of the day and they try something else and then try something and then eventually down the road they manage to succeed.
I wouldn't say my risk appetite is as high as it might come see, because you know I did pivot a lot in my career and I tried the new things, but with a startup, you know, I went on conferences 2-3 years ago talking about my ideas, hoping that someone will build them because I didn't have the confidence or courage. It didn't actually cross my mind that I could go and do this.
That you could do it. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't. I just thought, okay, I'll put it out there because it's cool and maybe someone will jump on it and do it. And only 2 years later, with a lot of sort of encouragement from friends and industry colleagues, you know, it started to hit me that, wait, I might be able to do it. But then again, I was scared of the risk, particularly in the context of work-life balance. You know, I'm a mom who values the career, but I also value being a present mom, despite, you know, I have a live-in nanny from the time my child was 1 year old. So she gives me a lot of help, but I am still the mom that puts him to bed every evening and reads him the books. And, you know, I'm totally aware of everything that happens in his life. I've been there for the most important fairs of everything, and I wanted to stay like this. So my appetite for sacrificing family life for startup isn't there at all. And I always thought that, okay, so that doesn't make me a startup founder. I need to be able to drop everything. I need to be able to miss bedtime, miss school appearances, just not be there for my child to do a startup. And it took talking to people that did it, and it took reading, and it took realizing that I've been doing things my own way for all my life, that I can also do this my own way. And I've been very open from the beginning of the money raise. Like I'm not gonna do the grind here. Obviously I'm gonna work very hard, but my family comes first always. And I will do my best to accommodate around their, you know, priorities. And it will remain like this. I do not want to look back at the time of the startup journey, regardless of how successful it gets, and say to myself that I've missed the best years of my childhood. That's not going to happen. And I'm going to guard this really strongly so that my work and my personal life can go in sync and I can get fulfillment in both without these crazy sacrifices that a lot of people have had to go through.
Yeah, it has to be a must to have these priorities in order in order to be able to keep these principles at the end of the day, right? You really need to know what your priorities are when you go into
something. I do, but funny enough, as I said it aloud, and I'm going to be exactly completely honest about it.
Yeah.
My mind was thinking, why did I say that? I shouldn't have said that, because there probably are some investors out there that, you know, are interested in investing one day, and all of a sudden they're like, no, she's a mom. She prioritizes her child. Now this is not going to go anywhere. You know, this is the preconception that we've been taught. We've been shown these founders that burn the midnight oil and are single and don't have families, or have families and never see them because of work. And that's the image that we've been shown. And that's why I think it's so important to show women in these positions, not to say that it's only men that do that. But I guess women tend to be more open about the need to be with their children and not to miss the important events of their life. So that's why I think it's important to be showcasing the journeys of women and overall of parents who want to do startups without sacrificing their family life. Or people who don't have kids and want to start up without sacrificing other important areas of their life to maintain the work-life balance.
Yeah. I mean, let's talk about that more. I mean, you know, let's take a step back here. I mean, you know, you had your professional career as an employee, and then you became a consultant, and then you had this great idea of shared play. I don't know if you still say shared play or if it's something else right now, but
it's going to be soon play. Rebranded. But yeah, it's still right. Shared play.
Okay. Still shared play. Basically, where you wanted to create this social casino product, essentially, and you know that's when we got to know each other, was when you were looking for investment. And I remember one of our first calls ever was the fact that you were struggling and you felt you weren't sure if this was actually going to be able to reach that investment. And can you talk about how that investment process was? Because it's the first time you were seeking investment. And, you know, there's so many people who have fantastic ideas, but they don't know where to start, how to begin. You know, how do you get your idea into the investors and then eventually get money into the account to create the idea that you have?
Yeah, so not many people know that, but it was not my first time trying to secure investment. Okay. It was my second idea. And I sort of had a trial run. But for many, this trial run and the rejection I received would have been it. And it was almost it for me, because I had an idea for a table games company, which actually was validated in the market, because there is a similar product called Real Dealer on the market. And I know there are a couple of other companies are pursuing, but I wanted to do pre-recorded RNG game, light dealer, multiplayer game, something like that. And, you know, this was my very first time. So I did the deck and did the research. It was a totally concept on paper. I didn't have the team. I didn't have any UX, any architecture, nothing. And I did reach out to quite a few people. I went to meeting at ICE. I went to meeting at G2E and, you know, talked to everyone about the idea and received a no after no. basically, people told me, you know, you're great. I'm sure you can execute, but this product is so niche. And it's just so experimental. And there's other companies with big budgets, and it just doesn't, it's not investable. And I received a lot of rejection. And, you know, I almost gave up on the idea of doing a startup. But then I decided to do another shot. And Tony, who is my advisor, commercial advisor in the startup, he was instrumental in not letting me give up. He was like, how about that other idea, you know, that we talked about? I think it's much more mass appeal. And, you know, you were always more passionate about this. But again, the sort of lack of confidence stood in the way, because I was thinking, but I'm so highly associated with expertise around live dealer and table games, not so much with slots, because, I'm not a slot player. I know slot from the product perspective. I know the games from the performance perspective and the numbers, but I'm not a math and volatility features specialist. I can't judge from that perspective. So I was scared to bring a slot product out, because I'd be seen as, you know, not my area of expertise. And then I realized that the product that I had in mind isn't actually a slot product. It's a platform. It's a transactional social product. It has nothing to do with mechanics of the games. I don't need to go into making games straight away. When I'm ready for games, I'll hire people with the right expertise in making games. But I'm very good at product and managing business, P&L and so on. So I could try it. So that's when we did another, I took another shot at this. And it was difficult, because I didn't know where to start with investors. I didn't go to Crunchbase and download the list of people. I didn't know the VCs to go to. So essentially, I had to knock back on some of the doors that I already went to and got rejected from. And that was difficult. That was really difficult, because I was feeling they're going to see me as a pester. You know, how many times can I say this girl no? they didn't know it was a different product when I was trying to email them. And with this one, it was a very different story. First of all, I've taken the product much further. You know, I've back then onboarded a really niche and skilled team of advisors for specific components of the product. We've done UX work. We've done architecture work. We've done some early work on the POC. So it was a different story. And when I was looking for investors, I wanted to have strategic people on board. I wanted to have companies that could be customers, because I came from an operator background where I've seen how difficult it is for startup technology company to get an integration with their first operator, and how important it is to have that first operator on board to be visible and to prove that your solution works, your game works, so on. And I've seen so many companies struggling because they couldn't get those first deals through the door. So I knew that I want someone that can provide that opportunity as a first beta customer. I knew that I want someone that is influential enough to help me secure the distribution deal early on, because I also knew that's important for technology. And I had this dream list of investors that I was gonna send it to and see if they said no, I was going to revisit if I want to do this again, because I was on the verge of thinking maybe it isn't for me, maybe my ideas are just not good enough. And so it happens that all three people from the list, the top three people, were interested in exploring further, and the top two decided to join forces and come on board as lead investors. So I was really lucky in that aspect. But again, it was not luck, because these people knew me.
Exactly.
Yeah. Leo Vegas sort of is quite aware of, you know, my skill set, competency level. So I guess this helped immensely. But I think the product was also in a great spot. And when we showcased the deck to a couple of VCs afterwards, not even for seeking investment, because we didn't need it anymore, but more for feedback for future, and also as part of the journey of sharing with other founders, the feedback was always very positive in terms of what was in the deck, the stage of the product. So it wasn't just raised from a deck. It was more than that, but we were still pre-product, and that large investment pre-product is quite rare. I'm still learning to say, you know, this is my achievement, not that I was lucky to make that happen.
Yeah, exactly. It comes, again, it comes natural. Like, oh my God, I was so lucky to get this or whatever. But obviously, it comes from experience at the end of the day. How much do you think, now you've been, you know, seeking investment twice, and, you know, you failed once, you succeeded the next time. How much do you think the investors considered who they were investing in, as in you, and what they were invested in, as in the product? What's your feeling?
I think it was important that it's me, because I, you know, I've got the expertise in product. I've proven I'm good with execution, and you know, I have connections to the right people to be able to sell the product and present it. But the first rejection proved me that it's not enough, that the idea also has to be good. So it wasn't just because I'm this person visible in LinkedIn and, you know, talking about a lot of cool stuff at conferences. It was also the idea that ticked the boxes. And I would say it's probably equally important, both the idea and the people behind me, and not just me. Again, I'm a solo founder, and quite often this is a disadvantage, especially when seen by the VC, because they say it's, you know, you don't have anyone to bounce your ideas with, you don't have anyone to share the pressure with, it's going to be so much harder for you. And I had a really strong team of advisors behind me, and the credentials of those people were spot on. So it wasn't just me that they were investing in me, it was me and my support peer group that also impressed them, and they believed that they can help me in this solo journey.
Yeah. It's quite interesting, I think, in general, and something that that was a lesson for me when we were seeking investment to Agiminex last year is I was surprised, actually, how much investors genuinely look at who the team is behind the product. I didn't realize that was a thing. I thought that it was investors are hardcore looking into the budgets, the numbers, and the, you know, really scrutinizing the product, and it's like, yeah, fair enough. There's I'm sure there are VCs, so investors who are more concerned about the balance sheet and those exist out there. But I think the general investment, especially when you're looking for seed or pre-product investment, are looking a lot at who the team is. Do they feel comfortable? Do they feel trust with the person? Does this seem like a person who is on up and comer, or and so on and so forth.
And don't get me wrong, I was scrutinized on financials, projections, and budgets, and all this kind of stuff. So you know, I didn't get away with that just because we had a good idea and good team. But you're right. I also in the past didn't know that it mattered who the people behind are, as long as the product idea was brilliant. But I think it all depends. Obviously, if you come up with something that gets market fit really soon, like, you know, Uber, then it doesn't matter who is behind this. I guess it's going to fly. But then there are certain products, and especially in our industry where this is a B2B product and we don't have a marketplace where you can just create a good product and people will download it and you start flying from there. You need the operator partner. You need this distribution channel. There's the whole licensing and all of that. So you need support. And that's where strategic investors become really valuable, because they can facilitate some of these first steps for you.
It depends as well on I think what the idea you're bringing to the table is if it's a very specific product that the investor just doesn't believe in, and this is just a very niche thing covering a niche part of the industry, it doesn't matter if you're the world champion. At the end of the day, you're going to do it the best you can and it's going to fail. But other products, other ideas are much more plastic, let's say. They can change. And I think those are the ideas as well at the end of the day, where a lot of investors feel like, you know what, the idea, I don't know if it's going to work or not, kind of thing. It has a place in the market, but this team seems like they will just figure it out at the end of the day. If they're talented, if they're really good, if they're really clever, they'll figure it out. They change where they need to change. They'll make the strategic changes as needs be. If they are not world champions in creating really high level budget forecasts and whatever, that's where perhaps the investor can step in and help the investee out, for example. Because they do, at the end of the day, it makes sense. You know, if I would start investing eventually, for me it would be highly important who the people is. You know, do I feel? I mean, it's when you employ someone, it's the same. You know, you don't necessarily want to go for the person who has all the experience in the world. If you have someone who is a really hungry up and comer with limited experience, you know, it depends on what position you want to fill. I always bring up Lassen as a great example of this. Lassen Marzug, who went from being a low-ranking affiliate company in a pretty small operator to the CEO of a billion-euro company in 6 years, right? Mm-hmm. So he's young, relatively young, let's say. Why did he manage to achieve that growth? It's because clearly the management above him saw that this is a guy who will just figure stuff out. You know, he's never led a boardroom meeting before, but you know what? He's gonna look at YouTube videos for 6 hours. He's gonna read articles he needs to read, and he's gonna put together this report the way it needs to look. It's a skill to have that eye to spot those people, I think, as well. You know?
But I think it's also important, especially in the case of solo founders and people that investors did take in consideration investing in a startup because of them as well, that the product and the company isn't solely dependent on you, because then that's a risk for future.
That's a danger.
So, you know, for us from the beginning, it was about diversifying the dependency in the company. So it's not just on me. We have hired some of the best people from the industry. You know, we've got an amazing head of product with gaming experience coming to us from Gig. We've hired a COO that is a very prominent female industry figure that I will be able to announce very soon. And it won't come as a surprise to many, but it will definitely be big news. And it's a great score for us. We have also hired a CTO, also female, which I didn't think it was possible to make happen, but somehow things just, you know, came together for that. So, and every single person in the company is someone that I would personally invest in if they came with a startup idea. So that makes me feel like, you know, I'm no longer a solo founder. I was a solo founder when we raised investment, but I have a team of partners in this now, not employees. Because I didn't choose at this very early stage. I find them, they are founding employees to a certain extent. So I'm extremely happy. And again, I want to say I'm lucky that these people became available or came on my way or applied, but I'm not lucky. It's hard work to get to the point where my project and my company can impress them enough to consider this as their next career move. So. I lost your sound.
Sorry. It's my bad. I was pressing the mute button here. I was coughing a little bit in between. But so Karina, I think what you mentioned is really interesting, because there is a love for these high achieving entrepreneurs out there that isn't necessarily 100% justified. And what I mean by that is, look at the best example of this. You know, who is the Tony Stark in real life? you know, it's Elon Musk, right? He's seen as this, you know, godly figure that is just leading humanity forward in many different branches, right? And the upside to that is, as long as Elon Musk is mentally well, that works great for the organization. But the moment he falls off his pedestal, the moment he is not able to keep that productivity, if something goes wrong, then if he is the, you know, there's this kind of perception of Elon Musk that he knows every single little mechanical detail within the Tesla cars, for example, or every little detail about his rockets, you know, and that is, while that is impressive, it can also come across as very micromanaging level style decision making. And when you infuse that type of decision making process into an organization, very difficult than to change leadership all of a sudden, because you at the same time you need to change the entire culture of the organization, and so maybe it isn't so straightforward to kind of create these love stories about you know, being a leader like Elon Musk. Maybe that is not the right way to do it. In the end of the day, you want your organization to be able to function equally well without the entrepreneur at the helm. That should be the long-term goal. I mean, if you the investors eventually will be looking to make an exit, perhaps. And within that exit strategy should obviously be that whoever buys and acquires the company should be able to take it and improve it without your leadership. And that is, I think, a challenge that a lot of, certainly myself, you know, I definitely is facing that that issue where, like, you know, I feel the pressure to come up with a lot of ideas, you know, and I need to remind myself a lot of times to also allow my employees to be able to take a step forward and to create their own ideas. Because if I even if I you know, convince myself that I am the master with all these great ideas, it's like, well, that is just going to hold back the employees from feeling that they can even come up with their own ideas, you know. So that is also a consideration here. Is that something you think a lot about as well? And it's connected as well a bit with your management style, like how?
Totally, I believe in being a leader for your team and being the dominative figure, but I don't believe in sort of one single dominative figure representing a company. I want every single person in our company to be a brand ambassador. I've chosen people based on their opportunity, their ability to represent the company as well. So, you know, I have promoted the company a lot since the beginnings with my personal brand, because I enjoy great visibility and I have a lot of people following the journey. So I use that, of course, but I can't wait to share the spotlight. I don't want to be just that one person. This is my company. This is me and my ideas. This is us. This is Shared Play, or the new name that we'll be adopting very soon. And this is something I can't wait for. The guys are coming over to Warsaw in a week's time, with the sole purpose of coming together as a team, because we're scared there's going to be more lockdowns. And, you know, we are fully remote, but the plan was always to meet up and brainstorm together. But I just don't feel it's going to be possible with all the restrictions tightening and so on. So we have, while we can, the get together in Warsaw next week. And one of the main points on the agenda is to revisit the product from the ground up, the personas that we are addressing, the goals that we have for this, because we now have a part of developers, we have commercial people and technical people with wealth of experience from the industry that I want them to challenge me on what I thought is the way to build this and the features and so on. And a part of that, we're also implementing a completely new thing into our product development process, where we validate the features directly with the players community. We are hiring a person specifically sort of experienced in dealing with the community and well known within the streamer community as well, so that we can validate the idea. So they're not just based, because they're experimental, they're not based on existing problem or an issue. They are more addressing the need And there is a lot of sort of space for getting things wrong in there. So one thing is to be visionary, but another thing is not to get your vision too detached from reality and for what players really want, what they are ready for. So we're going to be doing a lot of this validation within team internally and also with the end users to make sure that it's not just my perception of what this should be.
Brilliant, Carolina. I think that's a great way of thinking. We're going to start rounding off a little bit here, Carolina, but I have two more questions. And you know, you're very progressive in the way you think in general. You know, we speak a lot about diversity and inclusion, but also another area we talked a lot about in the Clubhouse chat, for example, is the remote working situation. Should people go back to the office? Should they be able to work remotely freely? And in one of the Clubhouse sessions that we had, by the way, everyone should join them, Thursdays, 10 a.m., they're wonderful. our friend Robert Lenshofer, he had been listening into a seminar where an expert were talking about how to build an organization with a remote workforce versus working in the office. And the argument was that you can create a great organization completely remote, and you can create a great organization that that works in an office. But he said that the problem is that you can't have a part of your workforce working remote and part of the workforce working in the office, because that creates two separate cultures, two separate streams of communication, and so on and so forth. So either you should go fully remote or you should go fully into the office, or at least you should harmonize the company in a way so that everyone works, or most people work in the same way. What's your thoughts on remote working? And do you agree with this sentiment that it should be kind of either or? And how do you pursue it now with Childplay?
I don't know about the hybrid, because I don't have experience with organization where part of the workforce is hybrid and part is remote. And I do see that point that it could be clash and it could be alienating to some. We are fully remote at the moment in Childplay. We are based, you know, in Malta, Spain, Amsterdam, London, and Poland. So naturally, people work from home, but we also are sorting out office spaces in each location for when people want to get away from their work environment. And if they don't have the right conditions to work from home, they can work from there. So more the aspect of hot desking. But for sure, when we get to the point that, for example, we'd have more developers in Warsaw, and they would be in one space, especially if we outsource, then I would potentially look up for specific advice and training in that area. Because what I've seen with many organizations is they grow big, and at the beginning they do things sort of by a gut feel, and that's fine because that's part of the authenticity. But they only look for advice in areas where they don't have expertise when they're already too big, and when it requires massive change to structures, culture, people's expectations. So I would want to learn from that experience, because I've seen it in not just one, but many organizations, and try to approach it proactively. So maybe look to the future and before we grow too big and before things get out of hand where we don't know how to handle it correctly, find out how to do it properly upfront, and follow the steps of experts that have been there before and have data and have hands-on experience, and try to implement ways of working and processes that are not gonna create this sort of non-inclusive culture for people working from home, from the office, and so on. But at the moment, you know, we are totally flexible, fully remote, and it's to the point that I told my guys, like, I don't care how many days holidays you want to take in a year. You know, we all agree on the paid holiday allowance, but as long as your leave is not disruptive to the company and you want to take longer leave and we get the right notice to prepare as a team, I don't see why not. Like, I've always worked like that, and it gave me great level of comfort with handling work and private life. And I want to give it to people as long as I can as well. I know that when you become bigger and there are other challenges, it's more difficult. But as long as we're small, as long as we're a startup type of company, we're going to adopt all the forward thinking opportunities. And we even said in one of their videos, we might not be able to buy your fruit, as we are fully remote, but you get a whole lot of different flexibility and sort of perks that make your work really easy and enjoyable.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of thinking too. I mean, there's another silver lining of this pandemic is just that, you know, for we have gone fully remote as well as an organization. And that has just resulted in, even if I've taken less days off this year, but my work-life balance have much improved because I have a brother in Marbella. Sometimes I go to him for 2 weeks and I work from there. You know, I can be with my brother, check out nature, do all the things that I would usually do on a vacation. I went to my sister in Sweden the other week, same thing there, just really nice, sitting by the lake, working for 2 weeks, and I've been much more productive than usual, and mentally feeling much stronger as well, without having to, you know, go into the same exact routine every single day. That flexibility, I think, is only going to benefit, and it's only going to be a selling point.
I think it's just the beginning. I think this is going to trigger all kinds of other sort of policies within the companies. And I've seen Hero Gaming recently sort of announced that they're going to, or is it Kazuma or Hero Gaming, that they're going to finish at 3 p.m. on Fridays.
Kazuma, throughout
throughout August and July. And I think it's brilliant. I mean, in 43 degrees heat on a Friday afternoon, who does work anyway? So why keep them in the office, and why expect that people are going to be at the computer? Let them just start and enjoy the weekends, and that's gonna pay back on a Monday on a refresh sort of approach to things. And we do this with our developers as well. We have developers who work really hard in the week, and we do a demo at 11 o'clock on Friday, and then the rest of Friday is for experimentation, education, things that don't require that much focus and hardcore attention, so that they can just rest and get in a better mind space of letting go before the weekend, and that results in less mistakes and better approach on Monday. And I think it's just flexibility always pays.
Yeah, for sure. We have another idea that we want to do for our employees. Now we were thinking to maybe rent a villa in the woods of Spain. Location. Or something like that, in the middle of nature, and then We pay the villa, but then whoever wants to come there at whatever time can go and kind of work from that villa, and we can all kind of get together from time to time as a little combined working workshop and just enjoyment type situation. I think that is going to be more and more common as well as we go forward.
Not just for a single company. I shotgun one of the desks.
You have it reserved.
Cool.
Don't worry. Great. Last question, Karina. You are a big proponent of diversity and inclusion, like I mentioned here as well. And there's been a lot of talk in the industry lately about this very question. And I'm a believer that the more you talk about it, the more it's in the front center of people's minds. So I would love to ask you about your thoughts about diversity and inclusion. Now, as you are building Childplay from the ground up, how are your thoughts when you're employing and building their company?
Well, I do always highlight, I've never sort of experienced this gender standing in a way. So this is what I love the industry for, but I know that many have. For me, the biggest problem was also always the external portrayal of the industry, which is why we're trying to sort of make this friendly approach to how we promote the company so that we can reach other demographics that are not just working in the industry, but other people get interested. And I come across this problem a lot when we're hiring people, where they don't necessarily think the industry is ethical, or they will look bad on their CV or whatever, especially when you talk to highly skilled tech people. So it's a lot of explaining and a lot of sort of talking about responsible gaming features and how our industry is regulated, and that we're actually doing quite a lot in the area, not just as a company, but as an industry. But when it comes to women, obviously I had this dream that the company will have diverse workforce, and especially when it comes to tech. And when we were looking for CTO and developers, it was so hard in Poland. So I kind of hit the brick wall, and I was going, okay, I made all the effort possible. I probably sat on 6 different panels when it comes to women in gaming type of events to promote the company and to promote the fact that we're hiring. I reached out to all kind of organizations. So I made the effort. It was still quite difficult because the women developers are so highly in demand that they get scooped up by Google, Facebook, and all these type of companies. So in Poland, the talent, female talent is very short. But I didn't give up. I was just thinking, let's keep it in mind. And I write our job descriptions in an inclusive way, and I highlight the fact that this is a friendly place for women to work for, purely because I believe in it, but also because I'm a woman, it's easier for me to facilitate because I know what the needs are. And then so it happens, 3 months later, we managed to create the whole C-level management of the company consists of industry females. So it just showed that making the effort really paid off, because I didn't do anything that would discriminate men. I just was making more effort in looking for women, in reaching out to them harder, posting on all the groups, networking hard to get to the right women to speak to them. And it paid off. So I'm proud to say that we're at this point where we're quite small, very diverse in terms of gender. Hopefully we're going to be able to also champion other minorities as we grow, because it's not only about gender. So that's always going to be at the forefront of my agenda, because I really, really believe in it. And the industry is going the right way as well. Maybe a couple of slip-ups with, media scandals as of late. But at the end of the day, it all turns out to bring some positive change. So...
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's the point. At the end of the day, a couple of years ago, these slip-ups would have not been noticed, because the discussions were just not there. Whereas now it is more front and center, and people notice slip-ups more easier when they see them. So I think for me that just means that the industry is making progress at the end of the day.
Mm. Absolutely, it is. It's great to see.
Carolina, it's been an absolute pleasure to go through this. I would say it's almost like a therapy hour together. So thank you for that. It's been great. I hope it's been of value to people who are listening in as well. Also, Carolina, before we end, I just want to say that it's an absolute honor to be working together with you, and the year and a half that I've gotten to know you have made me a better professional as well. So I wanted to say thank you for that.
That's super kind, and likewise, I think it's great to be able to have someone to bounce ideas with and have similar journeys with. So it's great, and thanks for having me here.
Awesome. Let's continue our journey.
Thanks. Very good.
Take care, Carolina. Thank you.
Bye.